less safe because of Kathy Hochul and extreme policies.
He opposes sensible gun safety laws as well as opposing a woman's right to choose.
This is live election coverage from WNYC. Good evening, everyone. I'm Brian Lehrer. Those clips, of course, were Lee Zeldin and Kathy Hochul, the 5 seconds apiece version of their campaigns, as pulled from the one broadcast debate that they held last month, as heard live here on the station. And here we go. The governorship of New York is at stake. Control of Congress is at stake, and all the issues that go with it. Democracy itself is at stake if votes are suppressed or if valid election results are canceled by partisan state legislators or anyone else. The polls closed an hour ago in Kentucky. Why am I saying Kentucky? First place, where a very important abortion referendum is on the ballot. That's what Kentucky is right now, one that has implications beyond that one state. The polls have just closed at 7 o'clock in Florida, Georgia, and New Hampshire. Georgia and New Hampshire both being crucial swing states in the battle for control of the Senate. And at 7:30, the polls will close in Ohio, where the Tim Ryan versus J.D. Vance Senate race is also one of the most closely watched in the country. So in this hour, we'll see if we get any meaningful early returns from any of those states. We will also take your calls. I'll give you the question we're asking in a minute. And we'll get election night and bigger picture analysis from my three co-pilots for this hour. Melissa Harris-Perry, host of The Takeaway, heard 9 a.m. and 3 p.m. weekdays on the station. She is also the Maya Angelou Presidential Chair at Wake Forest University in the Department of Politics and International Affairs, the Department of Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies, and the Program in Environment and Sustainability. Christina Greer, Fordham University Political Science Professor, author of the book Black Ethnics, host of a Black History Trivia podcast from The Griot called The Blackest Questions, and co-host of the New York Politics podcast, FAQ NYC. And Gabriel DeBenedetti, national correspondent for New York Magazine and author of the new book, The Long Alliance, The Imperfect Union of Joe Biden and Barack Obama. So, Melissa, Christina, Gabe, thanks for coming on for this first hour of election night on WNYC. Are you all there? Can you all hear me?
Yes, Brian.
We're here.
Good. And listeners, here's our question for you for this hour. What was the dominant emotion that you felt as you voted in this election? And was that different for you from elections past? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. Remember President Obama's campaign slogan, Hope and Change, in 2008, that included the emotion hope? Is anyone voting with hope in your heart as a dominant feeling this year? Maybe not too many of you, I imagine, but call if you are. 212-433-WNYC. Who's voting this year experiencing a lot of fear? Maybe you fear one thing and candidates are trying to convince you to fear something else. Who considers yourself a fear voter in 2022? You don't have to be ashamed. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. Or maybe you voted out of anger this election year. Who felt angry as you cast your vote? Or maybe you were feeling anxious or ambivalent or determined. Or you tell us, what was the dominant emotion that you felt as you voted in this election? And was that different for you from elections past? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. All right, panel. First, who's following what election news from today? Turnout and what it signifies, problems or lack of problems at polling places. Melissa, want to start? What have you been reacting to, if anything, that's being reported during the voting hours today? Or has it been pretty quiet?
It's been, in certain ways, quieter than we might have expected, given this angst about sort of the future of American democracy and that narrative that I think has been a pretty strong one across the entire midterm season here. I certainly have been following, I think, like everyone, what's happening out of Arizona. And not only what's happening in Arizona, but maybe more critically, sort of the narrative about what's happening in the context of social media, what President Trump, former President Trump, has been saying publicly about it. So these are, you know, basically a ballot, a voting machine issue about ink in Maricopa County that was then fairly quickly picked up into some disinformation that I don't want to repeat here on air, but watching sort of how that disinformation is moving and the ways that it can have effects on, you know, that extremely important race there.
Christina, anything in addition to that or more on Maricopa County, Arizona, and the polling place issues that they had today?
Yeah, well, Brian, I've been sort of thinking about Philadelphia, which is where I was raised, and, you know, some of these stories about how they're going to take some time and have a slower count. And we know that the Republicans have used the narrative that, you know, if we don't know results the night of, then there must be some funny business going on. So I've been looking at Philly because it's near and dear to my heart. Some of the anecdotal conversations I've had about some issues about long lines in Georgia obviously make me think back to 2018 with some of the irregularities we saw when Brian Kemp was Secretary of State and in charge of the elections then. In New York, you know, we've had embarrassingly low turnout, and so we've had some impressive numbers with early voting, and so I'll be looking towards the end of the night to see if New Yorkers really did come out for Kathy Hochul or Lee Zeldin. And then lastly, I mean, I did hear the former president take some shots at Governor Ron DeSantis, assuming that he'll be victorious this evening, and gearing up for 2024, which I think will start much sooner than many people are ready for.
Gabe, you want to go next?
I'm not ready for it, for 2024, that is. But yes, happy to talk about today. I've really been watching a lot of the turnout numbers, and obviously that's always a dangerous game because comparisons to previous cycles are completely imperfect, not only all previous cycles, but even previous midterm cycles because of changing patterns in who shows up today, you know, early vote, mail vote, things like that. I've been watching in particular Nevada, where there's a Senate race that, you know, I was recently out there to cover that one. It feels like that one might tell us a lot of the story of control of the Senate. Democratic turnout appears to be far down from previous cycles, but especially in Clark County, which is where Las Vegas is, you know, there was a big push to do mail-in votes or drop ballots and drop boxes. So we're probably going to see a rush of those, but not until later. And as a result of that, I've been trying to, you know, look at the messaging that a lot of Republicans in particular have been putting out in trying to call into question mail-in votes. We've seen that pattern pretty regularly, you know, ever since the last election. And so trying to see how that's shaping up has been fairly interesting. But, you know, that's the race that I'm really watching right now as to the question of control of the Senate. But there is a lot that has yet to still be determined on that front.
We are inviting callers to say what the dominant emotion was when you voted, whether it was today or whether it was early voting or whether it was when you mailed in your mail-in ballot. Our lines are full. Let's hear from a few of our first callers. Diana in Bay Ridge, you're on WNYC. Hi, Diana.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I'm a millennial. I'm 37 years old. I'm part of the Obama wave that was really excited to vote blue. And I just felt less excited to vote for Kathy Hochul. It was more voting against what I saw as, frankly, fascism. And also just living in Bay Ridge, I was excited that I could be in one of the few swing districts in New York City. But then when I went to the polling place, I saw we were redistricted in the north side of Bay Ridge. So I cast my vote for Dan Goldman, but I was excited to have a say, and I was hoping I'd be able to vote for Max Rose.
Thank you very much, Diana. So not as excited as when she voted for Barack Obama, voting for Kathy Hochul today and voting against something, against fascism, as she put it. Mike in Northport, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mike.
Hi. For me, it was a vote of strength. It was a vote of defense. It was defending our personal freedoms, defending my family against the risk of, you know, handguns walking around the subways or in New York City. And I'm an older voter, unlike your last one. I'm in my 50s. I voted a lot, and the emotion has really gone out a little bit as far as looking for change, and it's really trying to preserve an America that I remember as a kid and from, you know, many decades ago. And that's really for me. It's about defense and strength.
And so did that lead you to vote Republican? Am I getting that impression?
No, I am a Democrat, and I am fearful of just unchecked Republicans. I think they're brilliant strategists playing the long game, going all the way back to 2000 and even 2010 when they took all of the state houses and played the game at the local level. And I feel like we are all suffering the consequences of decades of gerrymandering and Republicans really trying to screw up our political system.
Mike, thank you very much for your call. Christina, I think we've entered a new world if the nostalgia party is the Democrats.
Oh, Brian. But I think, what's real is I think quite a few voters are saying that they're not necessarily excited about particular individuals on their ballot, but they're voting against the opposition. You know, what I heard time and time again, though, for people who were either reluctant to vote or possibly not voting was, well, New York is blue, so I don't really have to participate. And, especially when we think about a woman's right to choose, I've had to remind them that absolutely is on the table. If we remember, Lee Zeldin did not unequivocally say that he would that he's, pro-choice. And he just said that, he'd leave it up to the state Senate and state legislature. And of course, they wouldn't bring him a bill. So hopefully New York voters thought about, even if they weren't excited about Kathy Hochul at the top of the ticket, if they cared about particular issues, it motivated them to actually turn out, even if it wasn't for a particular person, for just thinking about making sure the tide in the opposite direction doesn't come through,
and
which is a real possibility.
Did unequivocally say earlier in the year that he is pro-life. He said to a campaign event of pro-life people, how long has it been since we had a pro-life governor in New York proclaiming himself to be that in waiting? Kevin in Kew Gardens, Zeldin voter, he told our screeners. Kevin, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in tonight.
Brian, thank you. I think I'm a first-time caller. Politically, I'm an oxymoron, a militant moderate. But in reality, slightly left of center, registered independent. I don't like Lee Zeldin, but I voted for him. I am concerned about crime. I realize the right is making it out more than it is, and some people on the left are saying, it's not a big deal. It is. Where I live right next to the district attorney. In a six-month period, I had three shootings in front of my building. First murder of New York City 2021 was in front of my building. I've had incidents in the subway in the last year that I never, ever had before. So, and I don't like that Governor Hochul will not budge at all on the bail law. Why can't we reach a middle road, maybe throw dangerness in there, like other states have? So, yes, I am a bit angry, and I'm not crazy about Republicans, but I voted mm-hmm. that way today.
I hear you, Kevin. Thank you very much for your call. Voting for Lee Zeldin with anger. Suzanne in Maplewood, you're on WNYC. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, good evening. Thanks for taking my call. I went with complete fear, and I fear for our nation. I fear that the election naysayers, the people that are denying, are getting so loud that they are squelching out those of us that can tell the difference between facts and opinions, lies and the truth. And I feel somewhat desperate. I want to do something, but I don't know what we even do.
Suzanne. So I believe. Voted out of fear to save our democracy as she sees it. Melissa Harris-Perry, I've been looking at the CNN exit polls of voters nationally after voting in House races today. These exit polls have been released by CNN early this evening. And some of the interesting numbers are the electorate seems to be older and whiter than in 2020, 76% white compared to around 67 2 years ago. 10% Latino, 9% black today. If that exit poll is right, those would be down. Also, a third of the voters were 65 or older. Another third were 45 to 64 years old, and just 10% were under 30. Now, I know exit polls can be wrong like any other polls, but they're of actual people who actually just voted. So if those numbers are accurate, that's got to be bad for Democrats. But a little bit better for them is that 32% of voters said inflation was their number one issue. 27%, almost as many, said it was abortion. I wonder what you make of any of those numbers.
Sure. So the first thing I'd say is to say that exit polls are wrong, I think, is maybe not exactly how we want to think about this. Exit polls are as you point out, of people who just voted and therefore voted today. And so one of the things that really has changed, and it's going to affect how we're going to be able to understand exit polls going forward, is that so many votes, so many millions of votes are cast prior to Election Day. So there's no surprise that day of voters tend to be quite different than folks who vote earlier. One of the reasons that they tend to be older, for example, is because they may not be folks who are working at, or have young children, right? There may be all kinds of reasons. We know that they are going to be whiter, and we know they're going to trend a bit more towards the Republican Party. So that's at least what our expectations are of day of voters versus earlier voters. It doesn't make the exit polls wrong. It just means the sample that they're drawing from is going to be a bit unique. So actually, given that, right, these polls seem to be positive towards Democrats. It doesn't mean that Democrats are going to hold the House. I don't think there's any real chance that that's going to happen. But that this may be less of a big loss and more of a sort of historic norm loss. The other thing I'll say is, you know, we may be returning a bit more to historic norms, a kind of surge and decline, as political scientists have called it, where the big enthusiasm, the big turnout happens in the presidential election years, and then you kind of decline back to a slightly different, smaller, older, more partisan electorate in midterm years. Now, 2018 really broke that cycle. 2018, we saw actually an increase in all of these populations, but that does seem to be a bit of an artifact of the realities of the Trump first-term presidency.
All very interesting analysis. And Gabe DeBenedetti, we're inviting our callers to describe their feelings, as you've been hearing, their emotions as they voted in this election. I see your latest article on the New York Magazine site is called Why Democrats Are Suddenly Very Nervous. What are they nervous about?
A little bit of everything, which isn't that different from usual, but it's more specific right now. One of the big things that you're hearing callers already speaking to that a lot of Democrats have been concerned with is that their, you know, ways of motivating voters, especially their base voters, but you know, in particular, people who they think might not be all the way convinced that they should vote for Democrats or vote at all, you know, they don't really feel that they have coalesced around one message that has really been able to nail it all down for those kinds of swing or unconvinced voters. In different places, you've seen Democrats trying different things, but there hasn't really been one message except for the overall thrust, which is in many cases, you know, we're better than the other guys. And in many ways, that is a reference to Trump. There has been a lot of push on abortion rights, obviously, which is a huge motivator for people. There has been a push to say the economy could have been a lot worse, but that doesn't tend to be a very convincing argument. And that's really what worries Democrats. In some ways, it does speak to what we've been talking about, which is that Democrats are concerned that there's a little bit of a reversion to the mean here, which is midterm elections, the first midterm of a new presidency always goes poorly in, you know, historically for the president's party. So very few people that I've talked to in the Democratic Party expected to keep the House. They were a little bit more optimistic about the Senate, but that really has slipped in the last few days because, to make a long story short, we're just seeing toss-up numbers in a lot of these places. And the way this usually goes on midterms when we head into it not knowing a lot with a lot of toss-ups is they all usually break in one direction. There's just been a lot of questions about who is more motivated. And in many cases, a lot of the Democrats that I've talked to think Republicans, even if they don't believe their messaging at all, the Democrats, that is, you know, they think that Republicans have successfully gotten their base voters more motivated.
It's election night on WNYC. We'll have some results, we hope, this hour. We'll take more of your calls. We'll get more analysis of the exit polls and other things. Stay with us. It's election night coverage on WNYC. I'm Brian Lehrer. with Melissa Harris Perry, host of The Takeaway and Political Science and Gender Studies Chair at Wake Forest University, Christina Greer, Fordham Political Science Professor and co-host of the New York Politics Podcast, FAQ NYC, and Gabe DiBenedetti, New York Magazine national correspondent and author of The Long Alliance, The Imperfect Union of Joe Biden and Barack Obama. And listeners, we're inviting your calls and tweets on the dominant emotion you were feeling as you cast your vote in this election, 212-433-WNYC, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. Few very early returns, no surprises here in states that have closed their polls already. A few senators who were not considered threatened have been reelected. Tim Scott in South Carolina, Rand Paul in Kentucky, Senator Welch in Vermont. All those states have had their polls closed already, and all those three senators have been reelected. No surprises there, as we say. Still looking to see if the abortion rights referendum in Kentucky, which closed at 6 o'clock, has an early result. If that's close, it'll take a long time, but maybe it won't be that close. We already do have that one result in the Senate race in Kentucky. Here's a tweet on the emotion that a voter was feeling. This says, I've been voting for 30 years. At the polling site, I always feel grateful for the miracle that is representative democracy. Today, I felt a fear. Christine in Toms River, you're on WNYC. Hi, Christine.
Hi, Brian. I'm so honored to be speaking to you right now. So thank you. I think I never in my life, I'm 48 years old. I turned 18 right before I got to vote for Bill Clinton. And in my first election ever, I felt so much excitement to be able to vote. And never in my life have I felt so much anxiety as I did just now tonight. I'm literally leaving, you know, my polling place. And while I was thrilled in one of the only red counties in the state of New Jersey to see so many young people, So that actually brought me a little bit of hope, but I was so much anxiety. And I think really because mostly I'm going to say the Supreme Court, there's been so many horrific decisions with the people that have been put in place, and they're all going to be upheld when we lose today. And I feel like we're going to lose, and that's part of my anxiety. And I say we, assuming we're all Democrats here.
Just the host, but a lot of Democrats are listening, no question. We're in the blue Northeast, and a lot of Republicans are listening, too. So, Christine, thank you very much. And if Christine has been voting since Bill Clinton ran for president, as she said, Harry in the East Village has been voting since Adlai Stevenson was the Democratic presidential nominee. And that was in the 1950s. At least that's what he told our screener he's been voting since. Hi, Harry.
Hi, but I was wrong. It was 1960.
Oh, okay.
It was the Kennedy election.
All right. So how are you feeling today? And do you remember how you felt in 1960 when you voted in that election?
Excited. I mean, I've never felt this way before. And I have voted in almost every election since then. I voted for Bloomberg. I voted for Javits. But the Republicans are evil. That's my feeling. Evil. And I'm afraid we are in for horrible times.
Evil is a judgment, not an emotion, the psychotherapists would say. But
okay.
You fear we are in for horrible times, and so that counts. Melissa and Christina, the caller from Toms River, said she was encouraged by the fact that she saw a lot of young people at the polling place. I wonder if you two, as college professors, can give us a take on the dominant emotion questions that, or I should say the dominant emotions that you're hearing from your students at Wake Forest and at Fordham. You've both been teaching for long enough now to be able to compare college students from some different election years, definitely not JFK in 1960. But what emotions are you getting from them this year compared to in the past? Melissa, will you start?
Sure. So, you know, it's so interesting to me. I always enjoy listening to your callers. You know, I'm not a New Yorker. Do not live in the city. I live in a very swing state with some very big elections tonight here in North Carolina. I teach primarily undergraduate students at a university with a selective admission, pretty privileged. And, you know, certainly many of the students who find their way to my class, you know, classes on race and gender, often have a perspective that is progressive. And so, you know, those are voters who, to the extent that they're going to show up and vote in a midterm election, are often going to cast their ballot for Democrats. But I guess what I'd say is, one, there's a little bit less enthusiasm than in a presidential election year because there's a lot less information. The second thing I'd say is, you know, what's going on with college students? We should be very careful not to presume that that is what is true for all young people in the kind of 18 to 30-year-old range or even 18 to 25-year-old range. Remember that going to college is still a minority experience, right? Mm-hmm. Less than 50%, well less in that age group, and that even among college students, they're one of the things that Republicans and conservatives have been very adept at in recent decades has been working very hard to recruit young conservative voters. Turning Point USA is really kind of the framework here for thinking about this. I've taught many, again, living and working in North Carolina, many Republican and conservative students. So, you know, maybe in New York, young people, the polls definitely means Democratic voters, but I would just say that young people being at the polls does not necessarily signal one party or another.
And also from that CNN exit poll, doing this from memory, I don't have it in front of me, but I believe it was 40% were college educated in the national exit poll that they did today. So just reinforcing your point that don't forget, even if you're looking at that age group, it's a minority of people in that age group who are college students. And as far as enthusiasm, Christina, even within that group, I mean, maybe it's a skewed sample because these kids are, after all, taking your politically oriented courses.
Yes, it definitely is a skewed sample, Brian. I mean, I co-sign everything Melissa said, especially when we think about, you know, the age group of those young men who were in Charlottesville, right down the street from UVA during, you know, their chance and during the Trump administration. I would say this for my students, I like to teach intro to politics every semester so I can steal all the smart kids from other majors. And, you know, a lot of my students obviously are taking their first political science course. Many of them, you know, even though they recognize they're in a privileged place as college students, because we're in New York, they're very concerned about school debt and they're very concerned about finances once they graduate and their ability to make money and possibly stay in the city. So that was definitely a motivator. People who tend to take my courses, I think, tend to lean a little left of center. You know, obviously, students are very good at sort of disseminating information about different professors. So I tend to get students who, you know, are pro-choice, who care about the environment, sort of the cast of characters and the issues that Democrats usually think about and talk about. And so, but I would say economic issues are on their minds. They were very aware that Republicans are trying to reverse some of Biden's initiatives for student debt. And they're very concerned about that because they see down the line that being saddled with debt could actually change their trajectory and their future ambitions.
Gabe DiBenedetti from New York Magazine. Here's a little breaking news from the New York Times. This is from their reporter, Jim Rutenberg, on the Times Live blog. He reports the Republican National Committee announced it has filed suit seeking to extend voting hours due to tabulation glitches today. Now, that's all I have on that, so I don't know if that's particularly in Arizona, where we know there were some temporary polling place problems in Maricopa County, or if that's in multiple states or nationwide. It's too late already in a good number of states. Do you make anything of that on first blush?
Yeah, I believe Jim is talking about Maricopa County, Arizona specifically. That has to do with something that we've been seeing throughout the day, where as you said, machines have had some tabulation issues, or that the area has. I wouldn't read a ton into it right now. Obviously, all these legal challenges happen, you know, they happen every 2 years. Every time there's an election, you do see things like this. Due to the heightened, dangerous environment that we're in, of course, we have to look closely and see if these extend into bigger fights. Obviously, there's a lot of misinformation going around right now. I wouldn't read into that one in particular as particularly interesting. Obviously, Maricopa County is hugely important, though. So let's watch and see what happens with that, with that particular one. That's a state where Republicans have been conspiracy forward as far as elections, election counting, vote counting has gone since 2020. So I would say let's put a pin in that one for now. But I wouldn't read anything unusual into it in this instance.
One possible strategy there, because Republicans tend to vote more day of than Democrats. Yep. Perhaps they have an additional incentive beyond, an honest one of just trying to give people a chance after there were some glitches for a while, just trying to keep it open longer for day of voters, because that would benefit Republicans. And while we're talking about Arizona, on the election denialism front, something to watch out for, the Republican candidate for governor there, Kerry Lake, I'm going to play a clip of her at an appearance yesterday in which she signaled that she won't trust the results if she loses. Now, you will hear that we bleep a curse word that starts with B and ends with RD when she refers to the journalists in the room.
We're so ready for fair elections, aren't we? And yet I know, like many of you, and especially me, I'm worried about tomorrow. Who's worried about tomorrow? And these b****s back there don't want us talking about stolen elections. Well, it doesn't matter what they attempt tomorrow, because we're going to show up like our lives depend on it.
Kerry Lake, yesterday. So, Melissa, if she loses, what can she really do?
Well, plenty. I mean, the democracy is in large part a little bit like a traffic light, like a red light or a green light. I mean, there's no one who actually makes the cars stop when the light turns red. We go out there and drive our cars and are basically trusting that everyone else around us has a key incentive to stop when the light is red and to go when it is green. The operation of democracy is really quite similar, that we have to trust that there is no key actor in the system whose incentive is to run that red light. And so I think the question here is really, would it get her seated in the seat for which she has run? No. To sort of fight against a clear election result. But I think, as you can see from the fact that national exit polls are showing that there is some, greater than a quarter of American voters who cast a ballot today who believe that President Joe Biden wasn't actually elected to the U.S. presidency in 2020, the capacity to spread misinformation, to disintegrate the bonds of trust in the context of democracy, those are real things that a candidate can do.
And it's not just Arizona. I'm going to play another clip from another state. And again, I mentioned New Hampshire before and the fact that the polls closed there at 7 o'clock. It's a small state. The counting may go fairly quickly. We may get an indication there between Senator Maggie Hassan, who is the Democrat incumbent being challenged by Republican Don Bolduc. But here's Hassan on MSNBC yesterday alleging things about what an election denier Bolduc is and how it may play out in their race.
Don Bolduc is an election denier, spent over a year stoking the big lie about 2020 in our state. He is actively casting doubt on tomorrow's results in New Hampshire, a state that has some of the best elections in the country, and has said that if in 2024 his preferred presidential candidate doesn't win, he, as a United States senator, if he were to be in the Senate, would vote to overturn that election.
So, Christina, let me turn to you on this one. Are you expecting an outbreak there or anywhere? And Melissa was just talking about some of the side effects of election denialism, even if the person doesn't actually get seated. But are you expecting any big outbreaks of that, or even worse, maybe state legislatures trying to nullify actual results in any key races? Or is that just campaign rhetoric for, you know, the big MAGA contingent? But people won't really do anything outside of going to court if they think they've got something real.
Oh, Brian, I wish it was just rhetoric. I think that Republicans are, you know, in a smash and grab mode. I mean, they were that way under the Trump presidency. And, you know, you think of a state like Wisconsin, they've been very clear that, you know, if it's not full Republican slate, then they won't believe it. You know, what is it? 48 of the 50 states have election deniers on the ballot. You know, 60% of Americans have an election denier on the ballot. All New Yorkers have an election denier on the ballot. These are people who are very clear that if they do not get the results that they want, they just will reject them. I mean, I think what 2016 showed us in the subsequent years that have followed, Brian, it's just so many of our norms that have held this country together, albeit, you know, tenuous at times. That's all they have been. It's just modes of behavior of essentially men in charge where they would not let this Democratic Republic slip into the abyss. We've seen all of that go out of the window. And what Donald Trump has excavated with his party and let the faction become the center of the party, where it's just we have a far too many individuals in the Republican Party who have now said, we will take charge. We believe that we should be in charge, and it doesn't matter what the polls say. And we've seen them time and time again repeat whatever it is that they feel until it becomes essentially fact for their believers and their followers and the members of the Republican Party. And then Democrats are caught oftentimes and far too many times flat-footed where they're on the defensive trying to take us back from the brink. So sadly, I don't think that this is just rhetoric. I do think that tomorrow morning and the days and weeks that will follow in some of these tight races, we'll see Republicans just refusing to concede and essentially repeating the narrative that they've won, even if the data and the numbers show that they haven't.
Let's take another caller on the emotion that they felt while casting a vote in this election. Graham in Brooklyn, a first-time voter. Graham, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. Really love your show, and I'm excited to call in. I've been living in New York for over a decade, and I'm an immigrant to America, and I recently got my citizenship in August, and this was my first time voting, and I went early voting last week to my precinct in Brooklyn, and I was having a little bit of trouble with the machine scanning my ballot, and one of the volunteers came over to help me and asked if I was a first-time voter, and I said yes, and she turned around and announced it to the whole room of volunteers, and they all stood up and clapped and cheered me on, and as I exited the building, everybody was lined all the way to the door and clapping and cheering me on. So I was crying and a little bit overwhelmed with how I thought I would be feeling with voting for the first time.
That is so beautiful. Congratulations on your naturalization. Congratulations on casting your first vote. Heather, up in Dutchess County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Heather.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Good. How are you is the question.
I'm doing well. So, yeah, this was a mixed emotion situation for me. Of course, I'm really upset over all of the threats to democracy that we are experiencing as a country and that, you know, the Democrats are likely to lose Congress. That's really upsetting to me. But I am excited to be part of a competitive race for the first time since I moved to New York City from Macomb County, Michigan, a decade ago. 2 years ago, me and my husband moved up to Dutchess County, and I was very excited to vote for Pat Ryan. And I was just also very excited to vote Working Family Parties in Dutchess County, just seeing all of the signs where I don't really think I'm as well represented up here. So that was fun.
Thank you very much. I hear all the emotions in that. Here's a little breaking news on an election result. I don't think this one was very competitive, but it's still newsworthy. This is from St. Petersburg, Florida. And the AP tells us that Democrat Maxwell Alejandro Frost has defeated Republican Calvin Wimbish for a Florida U.S. House seat. Why is this significant? Well, that makes him the first member of Gen Z, Generation Z, to win a seat in Congress. So he would be in his relatively young 20s. I don't know his exact age.
And, 25.
Oh, you know. Yes. And that's not a surprise. That's the Val Demings seat, member of Congress who is now running statewide, though is expected to lose today. You want to say anything about Frost?
It's exciting. Right? I mean, I'm sorry, this is Melissa, right? No, it's exciting to have, right? This isn't a surprise. Basically winning the primary meant that he was going to win in the general. But look, we've got a Zoomer in the Congress, in the House at this point. And, you know, these are the kinds of, generational shifts and changes that, begin sort of one person at a time. He'll be a junior member in every sense of what it means to be junior. But nonetheless, begins to lead us to asking questions about what our country will look like going forward. I think it's exciting.
And so we've got the youngest member of Congress, and I think the oldest, as the AP is reporting, per the New York Times, where we're seeing it. As expected, it says Representative Hal Rogers, Republican of Kentucky, won his election and will remain the most senior member of the House, a distinction he earned after Representative Don Young, Republican of Alaska, died in March. As Dean of the House, Rogers will swear in the next Speaker of the House, regardless of party. I guess that doesn't say he's the oldest. It means he's the longest serving. I think that's what senior means there. Mm-hmm. Sarah in Hartsdale, you're on WNYC. Are you calling with the emotion that you felt as you cast your vote this year?
Hi, Brian. This is Sarah. Yes. Well, I don't know if it's emotion. I felt a sort of numbness and a sort of apathy casting my vote today. I feel like I've been voting for a couple decades now, and every midterm, if there's a Democrat in the White House, then Republicans gain a seat. If there's a Republican in the White House, then Democrats gain seats. And I've been looking around at all my friends who I admit are sort of uniformly liberal, left-leaning, and they're wringing their hands and they're saying the democracy is at stake. But I'm just kind of like, I'm kind of over it, I will keep voting because that's what we do. But it's starting to feel like so much noise.
Sarah, thank you for your call. Christina, I know you have to leave us in a minute. Gabe and Melissa will continue on. But you want to give us a thought, maybe either on that caller per se or on divided government? Because we've been in so many phases where we have had a Republican president and a Democratic Congress or vice versa. If the Republicans take one or both houses of Congress today, there we will be again.
Right. I'll start with the latter part of your question first, Brian. I mean, I think historically we've seen Americans do like divided government because it serves as, as Federalist 51 has shown us, the separation of powers and checks and balances of the various branches on one another. I think what Americans don't like is gridlock and deadlock, where nothing gets done. And I think that's a fear of many Democratic voters in the sense that Republicans have said on day one they'll impeach the president and possibly Nancy Pelosi and several others. So we won't really have a legislative agenda, which will really slow things down to essentially a halt. As far as the caller's statement about feeling numb and just really feeling apathetic, and I understand that. I think I talk to my students about that quite a bit. It seems like every election is the most important election. There's a lot of Chicken Little, the sky is falling. But for many communities, the sky is falling and the sky has fallen. And so I remind them that sometimes you may not have to vote for yourself because your life may be fine for now, or at least you perceive it to be. But sometimes we have to think about collective action and voting for others. A woman's right to choose might not be something that you care about, but there are going to be communities who actually need to have that choice. climate change affects all of us. It doesn't matter whether you live in Florida or in coastal cities. Climate change will come for everyone. Economic issues really do affect all of us. Gun issues affect all of us. Crime and safety, you name it. Every single issue that's on the ballot these days actually does indirectly or directly affect some community. And so sometimes we have to vote with other people in mind, and especially people who can't vote, people who don't have access to vote, whether it's because of disabilities or because of poverty and they can't make it to the polls, or because they're incarcerated for whatever reason, and they don't actually have an electoral voice in this particular moment. So I would just implore people who feel discouraged or apathetic to sort of step outside of themselves and see themselves as part of an aggregate and not necessarily an individual when they're going to the polls, and think about not just their current circumstances, but the society and the cities and the country that they want in 2, 4, 6 years down the line, and either help people get into office, or sometimes you have to vote to make sure others don't get into office. And that's also making sure you vote for people in state houses, because oftentimes that's a launch pad for people who go to Congress. And all of these elected offices are in charge of a lot of money that we pay taxes for. And so they can sometimes use their money, our money, for good, and they can use our money for things that we don't agree with. And so I would think about the larger holistic narrative and the larger picture when going to the polls and choosing to go to the polls.
Christina Greer, thinking the big and long-term thoughts as she leaves us. Christina Greer from Fordham and the Griot and the FAQ NYC New York Politics Podcast. Thanks a lot. Really, really appreciate it. We'll continue with Melissa Harris-Perry and Gabe DiBenedetti and more of your calls as Election Night 2022 on WNYC continues. It's election night coverage on WNYC. I'm Brian Lehrer with Melissa Harris-Perry, host of The Takeaway and political science and gender studies and sustainability chair at Wake Forest University, and Gabe DiBenedetti, New York Magazine national correspondent and author of The Long Alliance, The Imperfect Union of Joe Biden and Barack Obama. And listeners, we're inviting your calls on the dominant emotion you were feeling as you cast your vote in this election, 212-433-WNYC. We'll take it on Twitter as well, tweet at Brian Lehrer. Now, in the CNN exit polls, 47% of Republican voters today called inflation the top issue. Abortion was down in the teens. Among Democrats, it was the opposite. 44% called abortion the top issue, and inflation was down in the teens. In the New York governor's race, Lee Zeldin was running on his anti-abortion rights credentials until the strong backlash to the Dobbs decision. Here's Zeldin at a campaign appearance before the anti-abortion rights group, before the decision back in the spring.
Go out and make sure we're getting the most qualified person to be the health commissioner, who is also pro-life.
Boasting he would appoint a pro-life, whatever that means, health commissioner. But then after the backlash to Dobbs, he started reminding people that nothing changed in New York State as a result. So Kathy Hochul said this.
I've heard my opponent say, oh, don't worry. The day after the Dobbs decision, nothing changed in the state of New York, so don't worry. You know why nothing changed in the state of New York? Because I'm the governor.
Hochul from the broadcast debate on New York One Television and heard here on WNYC that night. Melissa, one of the great contributions of The Takeaway to the national discourse this election season was your series on the she-lection, as you called it, campaigns in which both candidates were women. And the premise of a she-lection reminds us that women do not vote as a bloc on abortion rights or anything else. There are Republican women as well as Democratic women. White women went more for Trump than for Hillary Clinton, even when a woman, white woman, was on the ticket in 2016. Were there patterns you could describe of how Republican versus Democratic women campaigned this year on abortion rights or anything else?
Well, you know, it was a fascinating opportunity for us to take a look at these. So we call them she elections because these were these are campaigns where every candidate left in the general election is a woman. And in some cases, it was two candidates. In a few cases, it was three candidates. And you're exactly right. I mean, it is not only did white women, for example, in 2016, not only was there a majority of white women who voted for President Trump over Senator Clinton in 2016, but in basically every presidential election but two since 1960, white women have voted at least slightly more for the Republican Party. It split about 50-50. And actually, sort of the bigger gender gap story is that white men vote overwhelmingly for the Republican Party, right? So white women vote about half and half with a little bit of a benefit to the Republican Party. White men give an overwhelming majority of their vote to Republicans, right? So we see a gender gap there. But I think the big thing that we're learning here is that, you know, women running for office are not necessarily running towards women voters. They're running for every voter that they can get that is in their party, that is in their sort of policy wheelhouse. And so what that meant is that Republican women who were running in these she elections were seeking to appeal often to white male voters, and then also to white women voters. It's not completely true. We also looked at Texas, where something the Texas 15th, which is two Latinas, and a district that's about 80% Latinx, and so this was less about sort of ethnicity. But in those cases, to be a Republican woman did not mean that you were running sort of towards women voters primarily. Just one more point I'll say on this is there's lots of different ways to be a woman, and the she election series really gave us an opportunity to look at how queer women were running, how young women were running, how women who parent children who are their biological children and those who parent children who are not their biological children. All of this shows up in how candidates were presenting themselves.
Listener tweets, my emotion was worry. This experience reminds me of 1984, not the year, but the book, where truth was not fact. And somebody else wrote mixed feelings, but really overriding was powerlessness. Monique in Tarrytown, you're on WNYC. Hi, Monique. What was your overriding emotion when you voted in this election?
You know, I voted out of duty. My dad defected from this country, from Poland. And that was one of the things he always said is like, you know what, even though we probably canceled each other's votes all the time. And so I went down to Tarrytown, the voting, and I was just surprised how many people were voting. There was no parking available. So I decided to go later on for lunch. And then later on, I went and so I decided to walk to it. And it was just so exciting to see how many people were doing what they're supposed to be doing. And the last image I had was this mother doing a selfie with her little son with an I voted sign, just giving an example of voting. And it was just kind of democracy in action, and whatever will be, hopefully this is the will of the people, and it's going to be transparent and it's going to be fair and we will all accept the results. But there was just, maybe because it was a beautiful sunny day, but it was really lovely to see everyone participating in this process.
Excited to vote and moved, Monique in Tarrytown. Brian in Randolph, New Jersey, you're on WNYC. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Melissa. I'll be quick. I know you're coming up on the end of the hour. Determination, you know, it's integrity and dignity matter. And, you know, this election may not go the way that a lot of people want on either side, but I just think that the critical issue is I have two young nephews. I'm half Jewish, half Italian. My brother is the same. His wife is Jamaican. Two, you know, biracial kids, 4 and 2, growing up in Tampa, Florida. You know, I think about them every day, and I try to figure out, like, you know, how do you teach people how to think critically? How do you teach people that civics matter? That it's not a popularity contest. It's not the worldwide wrestling, whatever, federation. It's super important issues. And the right to vote, people have died. People have died for the right to vote. So this isn't just, I'm going to go vote for the celebrity that I that says the angry words that I feel. You know, you have to think outside yourself and think about your community. So, I mean, it's determination. I voted early for the first mm-hmm. time. You know, I just feel, you know, it is what it is. Life will go on. Trump won in 2016. Here, 6 years later, you know, we're still here. And it's just a matter of, you know, waking up and understanding that, you know, when people say woke, like, it's just about dignity and integrity and recognizing that in everyone.
Brian, thank you so much. Thank you very, very much for that call. We do have only about 2 minutes left in the hour. And Gabe and Melissa, we invited each of you to come with a race or two that you're particularly interested in watching tonight and that you might tip off our listeners to be particularly interested in watching tonight. Gabe, what you got?
Yeah, I mentioned earlier the Nevada Senate race because I thought that it really spoke to what was going to happen in the overall breakdown of the Senate. But I also want to highlight the Wisconsin gubernatorial contest because that's one that's very closely contested. Democrat Tony Evers is the incumbent there. Wisconsin, of course, is a big presidential swing state, but that's really a state where the Republican Party has consolidated power in the legislature and taken a pretty hard anti-democratic turn. If Evers were to lose, that would likely just continue and probably speed up in a very important state in terms of national elections. And, you know, if you're interested in election denialism, if you're concerned about the future of democracy, that is one that I would be watching very closely.
Melissa, how about you?
Yeah, I want to know what Gabe's dog is watching tonight in terms of races. Look, I'm a North Carolinian. I'm, of course, watching the North Carolina Senate race. Results are already starting to come in. This is between Sherry Beasley and Ted Budd. Sherry Beasley is African-American woman. There are currently no African-American women in the U.S. Senate since Kamala Harris left to become the vice president of the U.S. So I'll be watching that race very closely throughout the evening. And I do want to just underline your caller, Brian, who sort of made this point about, you know, the fact that this is not the first time that American democracy has been in a position of challenge. I am a Black woman Southerner whose father, you know, had to pay a poll tax to vote for the first time. Not my grandfather, not my great-grandfather. My dad had to pay a poll tax before he could cast his first vote. It takes a lot to get me to a place of feeling as though there is no room for optimism, because not only did people die for the right to vote, people died for my optimism, for my engagement, and for my willingness to keep doing the hard work of democracy.
And keep doing it, Melissa. Folks, Melissa Harris-Perry. Listen to her on The Takeaway tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock on AM 820 WNYC. Can't wait to hear your morning after show, or 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon on 93.9 FM. Gabe DeBenedetti, thank you very much. We'll be reading you in New York Magazine and your book, The Long Alliance, The Imperfect Union of Joe Biden and Barack Obama. I'm Brian Lehrer. I'll be back with an all-election results show tomorrow morning at 10 on WNYC. Gabe, what's your dog's name?
Piper. She's very concerned about the state of democracy as well.
Piper, you're a responsible canine. Election returns continue on WNYC.